Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Adam Thier, and I want to welcome you to today's book event on cyber safety in a Web 2.0 world, what parents and policymakers need to know. Congresswoman Bean is going to be here in a few minutes to say a few words about the issue and her exciting new bill on this front, but she's on the floor right now. There's some votes going on, so she'll come in, and when she does, we'll just sort of stop and break in and let her say a few words. October, as many of you know, has been designated National Cybersecurity Month by Congress, and there's a lot of efforts underway, a lot of events going on, focusing on this issue about cybersecurity and online child safety in particular. This has been a particular interest of mine for many years now, especially after my two kids were born. And when they were, I started compiling a list of recommended reading, good books, websites, tools, all sorts of things. Eventually I said, well, I ought to just publish all that stuff. And so at PFF we've recently published a special report entitled Parental Controls and Online Child Protection, a Survey of Tools and Methods. And really what it is it's meant to be a collection of sort of the best of, if you will, everything that's on the market, sort of the state of play of what's on the market, not just in terms of the tools, but also the methods, the educational efforts, the sensible tips, so on and so forth. However, I do point out right up front in the book, in the author's note, that this is not intended to be necessarily a book about sort of how to raise your kids or advice for parents. It's really supposed to be more of as PFF is, a serious scholarly approach to the issue meant to say, look, here's the state of play in the market. But I recommend several other types of books and things in my book. And the three best that I recommend, and I even have a footnote, the first footnote of the book, recommending these three things, are three books by the three authors we have here today. We have first Nancy Willard, the author of Cyber Safe Kids, Cyber Savvy Teens, Helping Young People Learn to Use the Internet Safely and Responsibly. We have Larry Magid, who's a co-author with Ann Collier of MySpace Unraveled, A Parent's Guide to Teen Social Networking. And we have Sharon Miller Sindrich, the author of E-Parenting, Keeping Up with Your Tech-Savvy Kids. These are really wonderful books, and I've recommended these to so many people when I've been on the road or speaking at various events, when people say, well, just give me the simple steps. Give me the blueprint, you know. Walk me through this. Because my book doesn't really do a very good job of it. I'm just sort of laying out everything that's out there. I said, well, I've got three books for you, and these are the three, and so we're lucky to be joined by these authors today. What I've asked them to do is to, and by the way, they have much longer, more impressive bios that I've dispensed with here in the interest of time. Trust me, they're in front of you. You should have got them on the way out. I wouldn't invite them unless they were the right people for the job, so believe me, they're impressive bios. But in the interest of time, I want to jump right into it so we can get plenty of discussion. And what I've asked them, each author, to do is to say a few words about why they wrote these books, what their approach is to the issue, talk first really for a few minutes about the big picture, and then we'll get in more in a discussion after each of them has said a few words about specific issues or questions from you about various approaches. And the particular focus today is really to talk about the educational approach to the issues as Representative Bean's excellent bill, which she'll say a few words about when she gets here. So I'm going to start by asking Nancy Willard to start with say a few words. Again, I just ask our authors to understand if the Congresswoman jumps in, we might have to break in and let her say a few words. Nancy, you're welcome to come here.
So thanks very much. It's nice to be here. I have a presentation I'm doing for Education Technology Conference on Thursday, and one of the slides that I present in that conference states, knowing how to effectively participate in the Web 2.0 environment is essential for careers, personal life activities, and civic engagement in the 21st century. But what we're seeing so much is with the fear-mongering that's going on. I gave a presentation on Monday up in Rochester, New York, full-day workshop on cyberbullying, and one of the women in the audience there said that she had heard a presenter from the FBI in Buffalo, New York, and that FBI agent said, social networking is too dangerous. You need to keep your kids off of social networking. So I'm talking about the shift that we need to be going through. And it's a shift we need to go through. We need to educate the press. We need to educate the policymakers. And most of all, we need to educate parents. Web 1.0 was largely one-directional. Web is information source. And the primary concerns were porn, predators, and privacy. Call them the three Ps. Web 2.0 is participatory. All users can post information and collaborate with others. And the new issue is, how do we prepare young people to safely and responsibly collaborate and communicate in this new environment? Many young people are using the Internet very safely and competently. But some people are at risk, some young people are at risk, and others are engaging in irresponsible behavior. And that's where our attention needs to be. The way that the Internet has been implemented in schools is not effective, primarily because of SEPA. SEPA directed that schools protect children by using filtering software, dictated a technological solution prior to the time that we really understood issues. The most effective way, the most effective technology to be using in schools is effective monitoring. And those monitoring technology, the development has been delayed because Congress acted too fast in getting to a solution. The Internet safety Web 1.0 approaches that aren't working include these. Fear-mongering. 1 in 5 children has been sexually solicited by an online sexual predator. In that study, 1 in 7 in the latest study, by the way, did not ask about social networking sites. 43% of those sexual communications came from other teens. 2 did involve some dangerous situations that were reported to the police. All of the other situations were resolved by the teen, blocking the person, getting away from the site, ignoring the person, or just leaving. But more importantly, they found that, I'm going to pull it out, 16% of, 30% something of those solicitations came from other females, from females, okay? 16% were aggressive, asking to meet, asking for a picture. And of 16% females, 16% of the aggressive solicitations came from females asking, flaunting, trying to get involved in sexual activities. And those are the kids who we need to be paying attention to, because those are the young people who are going to end up the victims of the guys who are quite willing to take them up on those offers. Simplistic rules, don't talk to online strangers. Kids are walking around Club Penguin in their penguin suits talking to online strangers. They don't believe you. We know stranger danger warnings are not effective, and they are not effective with kids online. Don't post personal information online. We've got research that says there's no correlation between posting personal information. NPR story. Assistant AG said predators are tracking children down using personal information they posted online and abducting them and raping them. I have seen no report in the 10 years I've been focusing on this, 12 years, no report of an incident such as that occurring. I constantly ask law enforcement for reports that predators are using personal information and tracking down. None. The Crimes Against Children Research Center study of situations that led to arrest, all of those children went to meet with predators knowing they were adults, knowing they were going to engage in sex. Filtering. Over-reliance on filtering is part of the problem. And promoting filtering as a less restrictive alternative to stupid laws that wouldn't work anyway isn't appropriate. Okay? And I know some of the organizations in this room continue to promote filtering as an effective solution. It will not block accidental access. It will not determine teen. It will not address communication concerns. But the false security in relying on filtering is preventing parents from paying attention to what they need to be doing. Kids are not equally at risk online. You have to address this from a spectrum of risk. Many competent kids are making very good choices. Naive kids need better education. Representative Bean's bill will help greatly in this area by providing that kind of information. Vulnerable and at-risk children are the ones who are looking for love in all the wrong places, and they're looking for love online. They are susceptible to manipulation. They're not making good choices. They are less likely to be able to rely on parents or less likely to ask an adult for help because their actions online are part of the problem. And those are the kids we need to get to, and none of the current legislation pending is going to do that. The approach that's in my book and that I'm now advocating to schools, et cetera, is the Cyber Safe Kids, Cyber Savvy Teens. When kids are younger, they need to be kept in protected places, not just relying on filtering software. We need to have kids, parents bookmark the sites that are appropriate for kids and then watch when they're expanding on. And every child needs to know what to do if yucky material appears. As they become tweens and teens, they need to know what the risks are, how to prevent themselves from getting in a risky situation, how to detect if they are, what to do, including when to ask for help, and how to make responsible choices. To get to the at-risk kids, we need to educate those adults who work with them, the social service professionals, and most importantly, we need real effective bystander strategies, so that the competent teens become guides for their less sophisticated friends. We need to totally redo how we're doing the internet in schools, and I'm doing a lot of work on trying to do that. We need to shift from a reliance on filtering to a reliance on technical monitoring, supervision, keeping kids focused on educational activities. Policy issues. We need more research. We need more research. There is insufficient research about what the true risks are. Secondly, we need to coordinate. We need to have a coordinated approach to address these issues. We do not need what's in the senator's bill, the inclusion of internet safety as part of E-rate funding. The E-rate plans are put together by the district's techies. Techies are wonderful people. They do not understand youth risk. Under NCLB, there are requirements for an education technology plan. Those are put together by the education technology staff, a step up above techies. And there are requirements for safe school. The only people in this picture who understand youth risk are the safe school planners. They don't understand technology. The education technology folks don't understand youth risk. The way to address this is a comprehensive planning approach within states that at the state level includes the Department of Education, Safe Schools, Education Technology, the Department of Justice, Computer Crime, Juvenile Justice, Consumer Protection, and the Department of Mental Health. And it needs to proceed in a comprehensive manner similar to the manner in which safe school plans are implemented, with one exception. Those plans are required to implement research-proven best practices, and we ain't got enough research. So we need to implement the requirements that will ensure accountability and maintaining and constant change as more information comes available. Thank you.
Thanks, Nancy. Larry, you want to say a few words now? Hi, I see Congresswoman Bean just arrived, so we're going to ask her to come on up if that's all right. Congresswoman, I've already said a few words about your bill and introduced you briefly, so I know in the interest of time we're going to let you jump right into it, but I want to say why she's here. You know, Congresswoman Bean's been a real champion on this front, one of the few leaders in Congress in terms of talking about sort of an education first, you know, regulate later kind of approach, which is the exact opposite of what's been the real problem, in my opinion, about a lot of what's happened on the child safety front in recent years, the knee-jerk effort to regulate first and not think about education. So thank you so much for joining us, Congresswoman Bean. Come on up.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Adam, for the warm introduction. And I'm sorry I'm a little late. We were on the floor And I made the mistake also of coming outside instead of going in the tunnels. It's about 100 degrees out there. So if I'm melting, that's why. Who would think it's October? But thank you all for being here, to Adam for coordinating, to Sharon, Larry, and Nancy for participating as well and bringing your expertise to this important subject matter, and to all of you for your efforts on helping promote awareness about Internet safety concerns. As a parent myself, this is an issue that's been on my mind for quite some time. Like all parents, our children's safety is always our number one priority, and we were always happy that when our kids would go to elementary school, the police would come visit and talk about stranger danger and tell them not to talk to strangers in the playground. And they learn from that, and they're safer. But we all know with the proliferation of the Internet, the playground's gotten a heck of a lot bigger, and the dangerous people that they can meet in the playground can come right into their bedroom. And certainly with the proliferation of some of the networking sites, that's even furthered essentially the availability of our children to potential predators who in some cases are using these sites as online shopping catalogs. Now, I know that those sites have done have put a tremendous effort into trying to improve safety around that, but it's something that we all have to be vigilant about. I became interested when I saw my own kids getting on some of these sites and some of the information they put on. I was even more concerned when I look at some of their friends' sites. And at the time, going back, this was last Congress, my daughters are 16 and 14 now, but, you know, so going back 2 years ago, some of the 14-year-old friends of my daughter, the pictures that they used, which I guess could be considered innocent, you know, when they're doing this or they're doing this and all that kind of stuff, but when you put it in a certain context, it just doesn't look so innocent and looks rather alluring, and they think they're just having fun, but they don't appreciate that it isn't just their friends who are looking at those sites. So we've done about 24 forums on this subject. In fact, we did one recently with Miss America. Lauren Nelson has made Internet safety one of her signature issues, and so she joined me, and we spoke to about 1,000 students at one of the middle schools in my district, and the feedback I've gotten has been tremendously positive from parents whose kids have gone home and talked to them about what we talk to them about. And we've usually included local law enforcement who can talk about something or someone they caught or some activity that was happening right in their own community. Because I know with my own daughter, when I had, there was a Business Week magazine, again, 2 or 3 years ago, it was a cover story about some of these dangers. And I showed it to her, and I said, you know, there was a girl that was killed because she shared too much information, and, you know, this person tracked her down, and she's like, Mom. And I don't remember how many million people were on the sites then. It's certainly considerably more now. But she's like, one kid out of millions of people? And I was like, it just showed you that teenage mentality that, well, it couldn't happen to me. It would never happen here in our community. And so we've tried to localize the danger so they can appreciate it can and it does if you don't protect yourself. But this is really an issue of national importance, and it's deserving of a national response, which is why I first introduced the SaferNet legislation in the last Congress. The acronym stands for Safeguarding America's Families by Enhancing and Reorganizing New and Efficient Technology Act. But I've reintroduced SaferNet earlier this Congress with a couple of modifications and reintroduced the bill as H.R. 3461. And it'll do two things. One, it creates that national public awareness campaign to promote Internet safety. It would do it through the FTC in the same way they already do a tremendous level of outreach on identity theft. And they help seniors know some of the things they can do to protect their Social Security numbers and other identifying information. They would use a lot of the same vehicles that are already in place to promote Internet safety. It would build on and improve their OnGuard online program. It would also facilitate a virtual clearinghouse of Internet safety resources through the OnGuard online website. There's all kinds of organizations, some of which you are part of, private entities that have tips and tools and sites, and so we would link those sites so that for people want to know, they don't have to know where to go. They don't have to have heard of these different available resources and tools, but they can go to this one place, and all the links and available resources would be there. Excuse me. Just overcoming my bronchitis here. And so it's a good start, and we'll coordinate the resources of several federal and private entities. There's more that can be done at the local levels as well, but we have seen a huge increase already. As I started doing them in schools, when I first did them, the schools weren't doing them. Now the schools have stepped up and gotten their folks who are teaching kids how to use the PCs to incorporate internet safety into part of their curriculum on how to use the technology, and that's been helpful. A number of our local law enforcement agencies have stepped up at the district and are also providing, and other private entities are doing the same thing, and so that complements what we're doing with it. So I guess as the technology evolves, we'll have to continue to deal with what those challenges are, and we'll upgrade the tips as we go. But I'm glad to be a part of this effort, which I think is a good federal start to extend the awareness about all the resources that you are all working so hard on providing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there time for one question?
Sure.
Is there anyone who has a question before the congresswoman has to run?
I just have a comment. I met with the FTC staff yesterday who are doing the OnGuard online, and I was very impressed. And one of the most important things that really impressed me is that they have just redone their guidance on social networking. And the reason they redid it is that they recognized that it was too fearful. It was not, you know, proactively educational enough, and they redid it. Now, my father was an inventor of food process. He invented the process for potato flakes. And his whole approach was you do something and you look at it and you see what's working and what isn't, and then you fix what's not working. And so that step is what influenced, that really impressed me as an agency that is capable of doing something and then looking at it and saying, not quite right, and doing it again. So I'm very supportive.
It's true. You don't typically hear continuous improvement applied to government agencies.
Yeah,
but,
and I was really impressed. That was so...
But,
yeah.
You know, some of us are trying to just move that dime a little bit yeah, forward and focus on results and see if it's working. One thing I didn't bring is we have a bookmark that we give to kids when we go to schools, and it kind of gives them some basic tips, and we, that continued to evolve as we got better ideas from other folks like yourselves. Yeah.
Congressman, could you envision taking some existing legislation that's in place, for instance, CAVA, which requires parental consent, and leveraging that to educate those parents while the advertisers are trying to comply with this law, while they're getting the parent in the process to apply to obtain that consent, having some sort of program that encourages the advertisers to then link into your process and provide more education, since the parent's being drawn to the computer by the child for the parental consent process.
That could definitely happen. I know I was just talking to Chairman Bobby Rush about some hearings we're going to be doing on this subject, and I'm guessing that in those hearings those kinds of things will come up. Sometimes you have standalone things. Sometimes they end up merging together.
Our business does the processing of consent under CAVA, the Safe Harbor, and parents are sort of live on the phone and live in the process and asking questions, and there really isn't any good place to point them to. And without pointing them to a whole bunch of different places.
Right.
So it would be nice to have a coordinated effort, since the FTC is in charge of
to say, here's where you go. It's a great idea. It would be a great extension of that awareness campaign. Absolutely.
Well, Congresswoman, thank you so much. Before you go, will you tell us what's next for your bill, how many co-sponsors, and how people in this room can help?
We're just building co-sponsorship on this newer version, picking up some of the people from the last cycle who were on to come back on. But I did just get the news yesterday that we're going to have hearings, I think, on the 20th.
Later this month.
Oh, later this month. Okay. Not sure yet. But we're okay. Yes. And I talked to Ranking Member Cliff Stearns as well about it, and he was very interested in seeing those hearings happen. So
I'm sure there's many people in this room that are eager to help out.
And so that once you have that, it helps to build co-sponsorship too.
Right.
Because then people know, okay, this is real. You're not just tire kicking. So
right.
That'll help us move along.
Well, thank you so much for coming and taking some time this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Free books.
All right. I'm going to be all up to speed.
Yeah.
Free
books.
Oh, all right. More reading. Good to see you all.
Thank you
very much.
Larry, you've been patient, and thank you for taking a pause there. But Larry Maggie.
Well, if I had to be delayed, it was certainly worth it. Thank you very much, Congresswoman.
Thank you. Now I'm
pleasure to hear you.
My 16-year-old's driving, so I had a whole.
Now we're talking danger.
No, that's true.
Yeah. Well, speaking of driving. First of all, I want to say I think that Franklin Roosevelt got it right. And I'm sure Nancy, after hearing her, would agree with me that the only thing we really have to fear is fear itself. And I say that not just as a slogan, because the problem with fear is, aside from wasting time and energy by focusing on the wrong issues, it actually puts children in danger more than it helps children. Because if the parents are like deers in the headlight, paralyzed by this technology, wanting to pull the plug, wanting to keep their kids offline, they're not actively engaged in parenting. I don't exactly have the number, but I know that there are children who are injured and sadly even killed in high school sports every year, football, soccer, baseball, track even. We've heard stories of kids having heart attacks as they're running track. But when my kids were in high school, we didn't say, no, you can't play organized sports because we read somewhere that some kid died on a baseball diamond somewhere. No, we talked about wearing knee pads at soccer and batting helmets at baseball and making sure that you gradually trained and got in shape before you ran a mile in 5 minutes or whatever they run miles in these days. And really, that's because as parents, we kind of understand what it means to participate in that particular arena. And I think most of us, certainly even my own parents, understood that. But when it comes to the Internet, we tend to be a bit paralyzed. We're afraid. So we watch a television show, I won't name names, that implies that there's a predator behind every keyboard and doesn't say how many victims there are, simply busts people who show up in sting operations without pointing out that the number of children who are actually harmed by predators on the Internet are a fraction of the number of children who are harmed by clergy, teachers, police officers, doctors, anybody. Should we prevent children from attending family reunions because the largest single group of predators are family members? Of course not. Should we prevent children from speaking to family members because there's a possibility that they might be a predator? Well, I don't think that's practical either. So what we look for is not so much trying to find creepy people and somehow brand them as unapproachable, but look for creepy behavior. When we find a registered pedophile, then we take action to keep them off of MySpace or keep them out of our public parks. But we don't make the assumption that any given stranger is either good or evil. Strangers are strangers. If we didn't talk to strangers, we would never talk to police officers. We would never interact with first responders. But I think just as the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, where I happen to be a board member, has revised its message about stranger danger in supporting that those of us who are involved in Internet safety realistically look at the situation. Nancy did an excellent job at reciting some of the statistics, and I think it's worth repeating that it is not true, as I read only yesterday on a major television news site on the Internet, that 1 in 5 kids have been approached by a predator based on a recent survey. That's exactly what the quote said. That's not true. It was never true. It's 1 out of 5 children received an unwanted sexual solicitation. And all of the data that we look at shows that, yes, there are dangers, but when you put them into context, the fear is not so much that there is a predator who's about to somehow reach through the monitor and snatch away your child, but it really is, what are the broader issues? And the problem is when you act afraid of this predator, you might miss some of the other issues. Cyberbullying is a major, major problem. There are thousands, perhaps millions of children who truly are victims of cyberbullying. Some of them wind up jumping off bridges or pulling triggers on guns or taking pills. Some of them wind up in mental hospitals. And many act out in other ways, including bullying other children. So when Congress looks at ways to protect children, it needs to look at it, it needs to look at a gestalt. It needs to look at overall and look at risky behaviors, high-risk kids. It turns out on the very, very few cases, and we're talking pretty much a handful, of cases where a child has run away with or been physically molested by someone they met on the Internet, that in every case I'm aware of, you can find that this is a child that is engaged in lots and lots of high-risk activity prior to that particular event. They are what psychologists call high-risk kids. So you can't immunize all of society against a problem that affects a small amount of children. What we need to do is focus, first of all, on those kids, identify the high-risk kids, get to the high-risk kids before they become statistics, and for the rest of the children, provide a good, broad education system. I'm very pleased with Congresswoman Bean's bill. Provide the educational resources so the kids understand the basic rules. If you don't take the risks, if you don't do the things that are patently stupid, the probability of you being physically harmed on the Internet is a lot less than probably being hit by an airplane flying low, you know, on its way to Kennedy Airport, maybe a little higher than that. But my point is that it's a very low risk if you don't engage in risky behavior. If you do engage in risky behavior, of course, there are risks, and that's why they call it risky behavior. So what I urge people to look at the research from the Crimes Against Children Research Center in New Hampshire. When you look at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's data, don't just read the sound bites. Go in a little deeper. Understand what the meaning of the data is. Because the data is not nearly as scary on one level as you think it is, and it's a lot scarier than you may think it is, not in terms of the terrible cases, but in terms of the broad issues. Kids spending too much time online. Kids not getting out and doing enough exercise, and our obesity problem is partially traced to screen time, too much time in front of video games, television sets, and computers. Kids becoming socially isolated. Kids not participating in sports and in social activities, not participating in family activities. Look at the broader issues. Don't just look for the fatal diseases that happen to a few. Look at the broader issues that happen to everybody, and that should be a very important integral part of any education campaign. I think it's important, obviously, and one of the reasons why I'm proud to serve on the board of the National Center, it is important to go after predators, to go after people who would prey on our children, go after people who distribute child pornography. But we really need to realize that it's a much bigger issue than this, and it's nowhere near as scarier as some people would have you believe. I really think that it's time to legislate intelligently. Every bill that's passed the Congress and the House and Senate, almost every bill that's been introduced, has been very well-meaning, going back to the Communications Decency Act of 1996, where Congress, in a very well-meaning way, tried to create a situation where pornography or obscenity wouldn't be available to children. But it did it in a way that didn't pass the muster of the Supreme Court and actually would have done more harm than good. And we've had a succession of bills, some I like, some I don't like. But the point is to really think through what are the intended consequences and the unintended consequences of a bill. For example, the book that I wrote with Ann Collier a year ago was called MySpace Unraveled. And by the way, if I were to write a book today, it might be called Facebook Unraveled, because that's the hot new site. And it, too, has its issues, and it, too, has its benefits. But I'm going to be meeting on Friday in New York with Christopher Lee, who's the director of the National Suicide Prevention Coalition, or Hotline. And what he's told me in previous meetings is that MySpace is his number one source of referrals. So, for all of the issues that have come up on MySpace, for the kids who may have had some problems, for the very, very few kids that may have had serious problems as a result of someone they met on MySpace and risky behavior they engaged in, there are probably many kids who are alive today that would not have been alive had they not been on MySpace, had they not gone online and revealed their angst and their emotional discomfort, and had some other kid, or in most cases, or an adult, not intervened and gotten that kid help. Wouldn't it be a tragedy if one child in America committed suicide because Congress's well-meaning bill that unintentionally wound up depriving that child of a resource that could save their life? So we really need to think. As Nancy pointed out, social networking, in whatever form it's going to take, and trust me, I have no clue what it's going to look like 2 years from now. If I did, I'd be investing. But whatever form it's going to take, the idea of the interactive web is here to stay. The idea that it is no longer a top-down environment where pundits speak to the masses, but people speak to each other, that is here to stay. That is what your child is going to be doing for a living, probably. That is how your child is going to be maintaining their relationships lifelong. My kids are 23 and 21. They grew up with AOL instant messaging. They are still in touch with their high school friends, and they probably will be until their 80s or 90s or however long they live. This technology is profound. It is here to stay. It is positive. And what we need to do is to nurture it just as we've nurtured other great technology, so that when we talk about how to make baseball safer, we don't do the Deleting Online Baseball Act, but instead we talk about helmets and keys and pads and better training. We can do the same for the Internet. Our kids are worth it. Our kids are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. And with the proper nurturing, I think our kids are going to do just fine. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Sharon.
Well, thank you so much, Adam, for having this. This is the most exciting thing for me because as a parent, I was kind of started this process about 2.5 years ago, and my kids were really young. They were 8 and 10 at the time, and I was just in the muckety muck of my daughter wanted a cell phone, and my son wanted to play games that were violent, and I was really intrigued about all of this stuff. But frankly, as a parent, I was overwhelmed with making lunches and doing laundry and coordinating pediatrician appointments and orthodontics and all of the things that parents are already saddled with. Parents are overwhelmed already with work and kids and fear, concerns, anxiety. I worry about measles and I worry about, you know, public restrooms. There are plenty of things to worry about. And suddenly technology shows up, and now I've got this gigantic other area that I'm saddled with as far as teaching my kids and guiding my kids. And frankly, when I started this project, I was very, very much about safety, keeping our kids safe, which is where every person, every parent of a young child is. You've got a sandbox in your backyard. You've got some bath toys. You're good. You don't need the Internet. And I remember very clearly when my daughter was born, my husband pulling out a long a fold-out of the structure of the Internet in a Time magazine and saying to me, look, this is amazing. Eventually, people are going to have this in their house. And I'm bouncing my one-year-old on the bed saying, you know what, there's nothing on there but porn. Can that Internet teach my baby to talk? Can it balance my checkbook? Can it do my grocery shopping? Can it make my meals? And we know what the answer is now. Eventually, I was paying my bills online. And not too long after that, I was buying my baseball tickets online. I was looking up directions online. I was doing my grocery shopping and my recipeing. It was becoming an amazing resource for my family. The next question was, what about my kids? Well, of course, they were pulling their three-year-old butts up to the table and looking at the keyboard and identifying their numbers and playing educational games. It was obvious that this is change. It's changing every part, every aspect of our family life, the way we communicate, the way we educate, the way we do business, the way we entertain ourselves. And so it is no longer an opt-out. We as parents cannot say, we don't do technology. It's just not an option anymore. Not only that, this is what our parents, like Larry and Nancy have said, this is what our kids will be doing for the rest of their lives. This is how they will learn. This is how they will work. This is how they will communicate with us as long as we know how to communicate with them. I think one of the main problems I see as a parent, and my kids now are 13 and almost 11, is that parents are racked with fear. And so what they do is they hold off as long as they possibly can because they're afraid and they don't have great, although there are great resources out there, they don't know where to find them. They don't find those resources in their normal flight patterns. They find a little bit of this and a little bit of that. They take the soundbite from those news shows, a soundbite from a little article in the newspaper, and they put together their basic understanding and say, you know what, this is just too much for my kids. And we know that 1 in 4 parents don't talk at all to their kids in the age group between 6 and 10 about Internet safety. That's 25% don't have a conversation at all. Suddenly, by 11 and up, we're seeing 90% plus parents talking to their kids about Internet safety. Why? Well, my guess is because they've had to confront something. They've had something's come up that they didn't know their kids were doing online. So suddenly they're having the conversation. Instead of being reactive, we have to be proactive. We are missing an amazing opportunity at 4 years old to come with our child to teach very basic Internet skills and Internet education and technology education with all the other technologies that now have converged, the cell phones, the video games, to include access to the Internet. And we have this great opportunity at 6 and 7 and 8 to continue to condition our kids about safety and develop an amazing foundation of communication between us and them, so that when we say to them, if you ever feel uncomfortable, just talk to me, they know they can. They know we're not going to freak out. They know that we understand what can happen online. But what happens is parents don't do that. And so kids are worried. They don't want to tell their parents that pornography popped up. They're afraid their parents are going to freak out, and their parents do. The issue is to start. We are missing a huge opportunity a window of opportunity when those kids are young, to help them learn good skills and to learn ourselves. If one day you get the porn pop-up and you're like, oh my God, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, again, you're smacked in the face with all of these things you need to, do I have the right spyware? Do I have the right virus? Are they going to be like mentally a problem now because they're disturbed, they've seen something terrible? Parents need to address the issues early on with their kids. Slowly condition them, because right now we're conditioning parents to be fearful. We are conditioning them. They're avoiding the internet. They're avoiding letting their kids go. And then when something happens, they say, see, I knew it. As soon as I let them on, something internet bad. And it's not bad. It's incredible. You don't see stories, news stories, about how incredibly culturally educational the internet is tonight at 5. You know, it doesn't happen. Or how amazing kids' relationships are with other people in other countries. Or how incredible how the internet is actually the great equalizer, because no matter what you are, what your issues or your challenges are, technology equalizes you. So that is what we really need to do, is we need to get parents, the education to parents when their kids are younger, let them know it's an issue for them early. Even though their kids aren't necessarily social networking when they're 6, teach them those basic foundations. Help the family in general learn some basic safety techniques that they can incorporate slowly into their family life, so that by the time their kids are, we're letting them go, they are confident and they know what they're supposed to do, and they know that parents also know. You know, we don't protect our kids from a bike accident by not letting them ride a bike. We don't protect them from the measles by not letting them come in contact with other people, and we don't protect them from the dangerous parts of the internet by not letting them go. We have to educate. That's my story. So.
Wonderful.
Well, those were excellent opening remarks. I'm going to ask the crowd to get some questions ready, but let me first ask our three authors. They have forgotten to mention that they all have wonderful websites, and shame on you for not self-promoting. That's the first job of every good author. You have to promote your own work.
Hey, you forgot to put our URLs on.
I know. I didn't put them on your bios. I apologize. Now's your chance. Nancy, what's your website?
Okay. I have two websites. One of them is Center for Safe and Responsible Internet Use. It's csriu.org. And that's my professional site. It's for my primary audience that I communicate with are educators and schools. And then I have another website that's under development. Everything is under development in my life. It's cyber-safe-kids.com. And that's for this particular book. And I want to show you, this is almost done. This is the 6-page reduction, the Reader's Digest version of my book.
Cliff Notes.
Mm-hmm. And this is going to soon be on both of my websites. I also premiered and will be revising a PowerPoint for parents that is associated with this handbook. And I'm going to be providing that to schools, religious institutions, community groups, et cetera, for parent workshops. And it's a Web 2.0 approach. It's empowering, protecting younger kids, empowering older kids to make the right choices. So this should be on my website by mid-October, and you can download it. And
we're going to hold you to that, Nancy. You better be there.
I'm pedaling so fast.
let me ask Larry. Larry, you've got websites.
You are on my bio. Professionally, I'm a journalist as well, and you can hear me on CBS News and read me in the New York Times and other publications. But I do have several websites that are related to this issue. One is safekids.com, and its companion site, safeteens.com, which have been around since the early 90s. And then more recently, Ann Collier and I, the co-author of my book, have created a website which is listed in here as blogsafety.com, but it's actually just been renamed connectsafely.org. And the reason we renamed it Connect Safely is because it's not just about blogs and social networking. It's about cell phones. It's about any way that people connect in the new world, in the world of interactive web. And ConnectSafely.org is an interactive site with a forum where people are encouraged to contribute on their own. And by the way, so far, Adam and Nancy have contributions, and I'm going to hit Sharon up for one later. We have some great guest editorials from two of my colleagues here, and Ernie Allen from the National Center and others, but mainly we have you. Anybody can come in there and ask questions, answer questions, interact. It's a social network about social networking.
Good. Sharon, you want to mention here?
Yes, my website is actually called pluggedinparents.com, and that comes from, I have a self-syndicated question and answer column that I've been self-syndicating. It's appeared in about 10 markets across the country, and five regularly have picked it up. And it basically deals with the everyday questions that I saw profanity on an email. What do I do? The questions that parents really are struggling with day to day. And I also appear regularly in Milwaukee to talk about those subjects too. And on my website, you can link to those segments. And every month, it's usually updated to reflect the monthly topic.
Great. Let me ask. Oh.
Can I interrupt? You forgot someone. Ann Collier, his co-author, who's now touring the world with her family, Lucky Duck, also has something that you've got to subscribe to, NetFamilyNews.org. NetFamilyNews.org. And she sends out a weekly news email message of reports on all issues related to Internet safety.
That's great.
She's really great coverage, really great approach, and anybody who's interested in this stuff should be.
That's a good recommendation. It's sort of like one-stop shopping on a weekly basis for all the best news.
Yeah, straight to.
Let me ask one brief question. You know, just a few weeks ago, I mentioned this to Sharon before we got started. My six-year-old daughter did her first Google search, and she realized after watching Dad do it enough times that if you move the mouse up to the Google search bar in the top of the browser, and you just type in a B, immediately it'll fill it out with Barbie.com because we go to that site so many times together. And I let her decorate some dolls and put on dresses and all that stuff. And, you know, I do this because I'm that kind of dad, you know. So, she's seen me do this enough times that she figured it out. And she moved the mouse up one day. I'm watching her. I'm like, what's going on? And she moves it up, puts a B in, hits return. She's like, I'm here, Dad. Let's go. And I was like, oh, boy, here we go. So, you know, this is where it starts, right? So we've all talked about education. We've got to talk to our kids early in life. But I've got a 6- and a 3-year-old, and I've already got to start talking to them. Now, I've obviously done a little more research here than the average parent. What do you say to a parent at that stage? I mean, that's the, you know, they're getting on earlier and earlier. Some of the stuff we don't want, you know, some things we don't want to talk to them about because it's really uncomfortable. So, Sharon, why don't we start with you and go in reverse order? You know, what for the youngest kids, you know, because we have to almost break it down by age group, right? It's
right.
A different discussion
right.
for preteen or teen than it is
right.
for
it
a kid.
It definitely is, right. So, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure.
It is, but I think you're doing the right thing. First of all, you're accompanying her. This is what you want to, this is the message you're giving, even though you're not saying the words. By you going with her and saying, okay, here we are together, I'm going to this site, and you see that I know that this is a safe site, and we're sitting here together, and if something is weird, you're going to come and talk to me because we understand that we're here together. Those are the kind of patterns we need to set really early. And then there are a lot of very basic things you can do. You know, you can put your child's links in their own folder. A child that's under 7 shouldn't really be online surfing around by themselves anyway. So you put their There are links in a folder. This is your folder. This is what you need to go to. But nothing else on this computer right now is really for you because you don't want your kids getting into your banking or whatever else you might have on there. So these are the kind of things that you set real early. You can eventually then set your own portals. This is your portal. This is your space. You go through. And whatever you've set up as far as their links, their folders, their guidance, the parental controls you may have put on that that's already built into your browser or whatever it is. You may choose a kid-friendly browser. Whatever it is,
right.
You do that, you go with them, you show them, and then little by little, as kids are getting to get older, you're gonna continue those conversations. You can start things like, you know, you never go any place online unless you ask. Just like you say, don't open the refrigerator and eat something unless you ask. These are basic things. Kids don't really see a difference between the refrigerator or the computer. The computer is a basic appliance in our house anymore. So you start there. You start with basic habits and lay that communication with you.
Good advice. Nancy? Larry?
There's two things, one of which you just described behavior that has some risk, and you need to teach your daughter not to do that, okay? Most of the porn traps work by mistyping a URL.
Right.
Children should never be allowed to type URLs. And this false security that comes from relying on filtering software, we are not teaching children. Don't type a URL. If you want to get to a site, because it's a mistyped URL, that will trigger, if there's any spyware on your system or whatever, that can trigger a redirect to a porn site. You teach children always, type the name of the site into the search engine, look at the search return, and then select the site from there. Now, with your six-year-old, you don't want your six-year-old doing that independently.
Right.
But what you do not want to model to your six-year-old typing the Barbie URL. You want to model to your six-year-old and tell your six-year-old specifically, we don't type URLs. We always type the name of the site that we want to go to in the search engine and then access it from that. But then, so by the time your child's 11, your child's got that down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Secondly, your child, even if you're there or whatever, could potentially get into a porn trap. Does your child
Well, that's what I was worried about, Barbie.com in particular,
right.
Because
okay.
There
okay.
might be some other sites with Barbie that I didn't want her to go to.
Now, we had a teacher in Connecticut who was convicted of impairing the morals of minors because the computer in her classroom accidentally got to a porn trap, and she didn't know what to do. That could happen to a kindergartner in every school. Because schools are relying on filtering, they are not teaching children what to do when that happens, and they need to know that the proper response is to immediately turn off the browser. They need to practice that and then tell an adult. And the adult needs to praise and reward them for responding appropriately and not get all freaked out because of what
Larry's got a quick comment on the
Yeah, well, the first thing you should do, Adam, if you're going to use Google, is to turn on the family safe filter on Google. And all of the major search engines do that. Or you could go to safekids.com and use our search engine, which is Google pre-filtered, and you can't, it basically turned on that way, but you can do it either way. Second of all, you really do have to be careful about browsers. I think you pointed out the problem with typing Barbie or Bambi or almost any other term of endearment is that you will find near the top of the heap porn sites because porn sites will use those images. I actually don't completely agree with Nancy. Now, when it comes to little kids, typing in a URL is probably scary because they're likely to make a typo. Actually, the safest way to avoid phishing expeditions when you get older is to type in URLs. So you have to be careful with search engines as well, but I definitely think that small children ought to use filtered search engines. I'm not talking about putting a filter on the computer. That's a different issue, although I do think that parents ought to consider filters for young children. I think for teenagers, they're ridiculous, but I think for young children, they can reduce the probability of accidentally doing this. But I have to tell you a story. When my kid was 9 years old, he was doing a study on geology. And I said, great, let's go to usgs.com. Boy, did I make a mistake. I meant to say gov. Well, back then, usgs.com, which Daddy typed in and hit the enter key,
took us a place that I did not want to take my 9-year-old to, as did Disney.com spelling it wrong, as does still, I believe, WhiteHouse.com. So you really have to be careful. Pardon me? Oh, finally? No. Okay. And one other thing I wanted to mention, I'm glad, Tim, you made something, I was about to say this, is one of the most useful resources when it comes to the age appropriateness of safety advice is GetNetWise, because in the safety guide, it's one of the very few that's broken down by age levels. And I think it's a really good idea there. So go to GetNetWise and take a look at that material. And you're going to see, unlike some advices where they give one piece of advice that ranges from 2 to 22, the advice is broken down for what's age appropriate. Because what is appropriate for a 6-year-old is not likely to also be appropriate for a 16-year-old.
And I wanted to mention there's a difference between filtering tools and sort of like safe portals.
Yes.
There are some interesting safe portal approaches that are out there, sort of whitelisted walled gardens for really young kids. I mentioned one, I highlight one on page 82 of my report, the Global browser for Firefox, which is really a cool little tool that some dads got together and created, which is a sort of whitelisted walled garden of just safe sites, and you can't break out of it once you're into it. So if a kid types something in, they can only go to a few dozen types of safe sites or something, more than that. But there are examples like that, and whether you're a Microsoft IE user or a Firefox user, there's tools like that, and then all the safe search tools Google, Microsoft, Yahoo makes available are actually quite effective in my opinion. Okay, let's get some questions. I saw Amanda had her hand up first, so wait for the microphone. Please identify yourself for those who don't know you.
Hi, that's loud. I'm Amanda Lenhart. I'm from the Pew Internet and American Life Project. And my question actually is building off of what all of our panel of experts has just been talking about, which is I hear a lot about, okay, so a 6-year-old is one thing and a 17-year-old is another. What I'm always asked and where I don't necessarily have a good answer is where does the transition point? Does a parent reevaluate on an annual basis? How does a parent use a computer, have one computer for a household, and have a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old? And how do you simultaneously protect one and give freedoms to the other? At what point are you initiating some of these conversations about opening up, you know, giving your child more freedoms? And where in their life do you do that?
It's a great question.
Well, having raised kids through all those ages, I've given quite a bit of thought to that. I do think that, as I said before, one size doesn't fit all. And I do think you can have discussions. And kids understand. A 9-year-old understands that their 16-year-old brother or sister gets to do different things than he or she gets to do. I mean, the kids are aware of that. There are certain things that come with maturity and age. And I don't think there is a black and white, you know, this particular moment or this, you know, at the 12th birthday they get to this. There are arbitrary rules, as you know, Landa. For example, COPPA says that if you're 13 or over, you are no longer legally prohibited from participating in sites like MySpace or Facebook. And then MySpace has its cutoff age of 14. And I think that those are fairly reasonable periods. I think at that kind of post-pubescent age of 13 or 14 or maybe 12, depending on the child, they become, first of all, much more interested in the social aspects of the web. They're going to become much more curious, and they have the maturity to at least understand some of the danger signals. The dangers with kids like, you know, 8 or 9 or younger is that they could, most likely the biggest danger is they're going to come across something that's going to be inappropriate, whether it's inappropriate because of their parents' moral beliefs or it's inappropriate because it will just simply shock them and disturb them. There's a lot of different issues there as to why something might be inappropriate, but clearly at those younger ages. But I do think that 12 is the age where we begin to seriously kind of make the transition. Perhaps it's no accident that that Jews bar mitzvah their children at 13. I mean, that is sort of the age where things begin to happen in that way.
I have slightly different because I have an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old. And what concerns me and is an issue that I talk to educators about really addressing is that by the time kids enter middle school, which they're usually 11, okay, there is a massive push to get on MySpace. And they're lying about their age to get on, and their parents know they're on. I gave a presentation to my daughter's middle school. My daughter waited until she was 14 because I do not want my daughter to think that she can lie about her age to do something that's for older people. And I wasn't thinking MySpace. I think MySpace can be used safely by an 11-year-old, but I'm thinking drinking, okay? I didn't want to create the perception that you can lie about your age to do something. I gave a presentation to her middle school. I said to the parents,
It is not advisable to have your children participating on MySpace before. They don't. MySpace doesn't want them until they're 14. And after I presented, the PTA president got up and she said, well, my daughter's on MySpace because that's where all her friends are and I think it's perfectly safe. Okay? So what I'm talking to schools about and what I'm recommending now, and I'm going to be creating resources for them, that's on my to-do list, is that we really need to start having these conversations, not maybe in full explicit detail, but in sufficient detail to address the sexual risks, because there is sexual trolling going on these social networking sites. We've got to address that in fifth grade, right after sex education class. And that's when I think that we need to start addressing some of the stranger safety and some of the issues. Part of the problem is a lot of the images that they see, and the representative Bean was absolutely accurate. These girls in particular have, and my daughter, has great difficulty in figuring out which images are appropriate and safe and which are not. And yes, I've said, no, that comes off. My son was a little more helpful. He said, Allie, that picture makes you look like a slut. Yeah. Oh, from the wisdom of older brothers, okay? But that is a learning thing, and I think it's got to happen towards the... Now, I know of fourth and fifth graders who are on MySpace, and I absolutely don't think they should be. It's also, there are better sites for the tween population. MB is much safer, and if we can kind of encourage parents to move in that direction, then they can postpone the entrance into the teen environments. But
we've got a couple other questions I want to get to, so let's move around here.
Hi, my name is Shereen Mitchell. I'm actually Executive Director of Digital Sisters, but I'm also President of Community Technology Centers Network. Basically, I actually come from a place where I want to talk about in terms of parents and the at-risk youth, because the populations that many of our centers serve are low-income, impoverished neighborhoods that include impoverished school systems. So some of the things that we're talking about, even getting parents to engage in certain ways around technology, many of these parents don't even have the technology at home nor the skills to even navigate some of the things that you suggested, Sharon, no disrespect. So how do we actually get to some of these issues around at-risk youth that will go and engage in these activities online? Because, yes, they go to school and they have their friends or the other person down the street that they can go to get access to these things, but they actually don't even have that access at home. Those conversations they're not having with their parents because those parents sometimes are not home, but two, because they don't have the technology at home. And some of those parents have chosen to not have computers at home just to avoid this, mm-hmm. which, of course, they get smacked in the face by the time 11, 12 comes mm-hmm. around right. when something has happened, right. not just at school, but, you know, at one of the friends' house or something like that. So how do we address that issue?
I do know that the NetSmarts program is heavily installed in Boys and Girls Clubs, so that's not going to achieve. That's not everybody, but that's certainly a start. And I do know that certainly there are after-school programs that are doing this. And it seems to me this probably isn't addressed in Representative Bean's bill, but it definitely ought to be a part of the curriculum in all of these programs.
I think there are two critical answers, and I address this in all my presentation to educators. We are not going to get to the most vulnerable, at-risk kids through Representative Bean's bill or whatever. Okay, we have got to get to two populations. Number one are the educational professionals or the professionals who provide service to at-risk youth, counselors, psychologists, community centers, etc. And we need to make sure they understand what these risks are and how to detect if a child that they are engaged in is at risk. And secondly, and really importantly, we've got to implement bystander strategies. These young people frequently will not listen to adults because, quite frankly, the adults in their lives have let them down. And so the competent teens are the ones who we need to get to as educators of their peers. They can advise their peers on safe activities. They can then they can also, if they are feeling comfortable with adults, that adults are going to respond appropriately. They are the ones who can report that adults to adults that someone's of concern. And I've seen many examples where this has happened. I talked to a high school student who realized her friend was involved with a predator. And she explained what this person was doing, how he was manipulating her, and why this, and her child disengaged from this person. I have heard from a headmaster of a private school who had a student come and show her the suicidal material that another child had posted. And, oh, by the way, the vast majority of safe school personnel in schools cannot get past the school filter. So if they have a child come in and say, so-and-so is posting suicidal material online and I'm really concerned, that counselor can't get around the school filter to go and investigate. And there's no way that counselors could be able to find it if they can't.
Sharon, did you want to add anything before I go to another question? Okay, there's one in the back, gentleman in the back there.
Thanks. My name is Scott Matthews. I'm the Office of Technology, Electronic Commerce, the Department of Commerce, but I'm speaking, of course, for myself as a parent. A couple quick comments, and one is that with my children are now 9 and 11, both got on the internet fairly early, probably because I use it a lot, my wife uses it a lot. But the internet wasn't the problem. The problem was still the playground at school. It was still what messages are being shared there by older students in discussion. So the conversations have to take place regardless of the internet, so that doesn't go away. The second thing is, my wife and I both created profiles on MySpace and on Facebook to learn about it and how it operates and what goes on there. And I think perhaps there needs to be some educational effort focused on parents along those lines, getting them to actually experience how it works so they can understand it themselves rather than just say, this is what it is. And finally, it's kind of a question or a problem I have, and that is both my kids with their access online, you get mixed, what I would call mixed message sites. Like, for example, going to Nickelodeon and wanting to see something about Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Great, perfect, no problem. But then at the same site, you've got things like Degrassi High, where there are some very complex relationship sexual issues being discussed. So it's on one site, the same URL. So you either filter it all out or you have it all there, it seems. So that seems to be a problem. I don't know how that's appropriately dealt with, is in these like mixed message sites. Thank you.
Good question.
Yeah.
Anyone on that?
I'm going to be taking this up more and more with MySpace. We're telling children not to post sexually provocative images, and their advertisements are over the line. And even for kids who are signed up as minors, the advertising images on that site are unacceptable.
Yeah, that's not supposed to happen for profiles under 18, but apparently Nancy found it. You raise a really good point, and I think that's one of the arguments why filtering is not sufficient, especially if kids reach the age that your kids are. Even news sites. Remember during the Lewinsky-Clinton hearings, we had a situation where our kids were watching television with us over dinner. And my daughter came up to me, or maybe my son, said, Daddy, what's oral sex? And that was not the time that my wife and I were prepared to have that discussion. But thanks to CNN and Kenneth Starr, we had to have it. And I guess we should bring in Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky into the picture as well. But I think it's critical thinking. I think that the key of all of this is critical thinking, is to work with your children from a very, very early age to get them to be able to make their own distinction and their own judgments as to what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, what risks to take, what risks not to take. Trying to protect your children against complex sexual discussions, you're probably going to have to move to some hole. I think, I don't know how you're going to ever let them watch TV or use the internet without that coming up somewhere. But the fact is that, again, with critical thinking and discussions that begin early in life, children begin to, if not avoid sites like that, at least have a better understanding of what they mean and where they plug in. I mean, the analogy I like to use is you could live in a world where there were no cars, and therefore, is that an alarm or a vote?
That's a vote.
Either way, it's alarming.
You could live in a world where there are no cars, and therefore your kids would never have to worry about being run over. But eventually, you're going to move to a city where there are cars, and so that's why we have crossing guards, and that's why we have crosswalks and lights. And I just think ultimately you're going to just have to trust your kids to make the decision. And chances are, if you've been parenting properly, that's going to work out okay.
Adam, can I say one more thing to that? And one other thing, I think that, again, I think parents often feel a little bit like they're victims, like they're faced with these issues, and it's not fair, and what are we supposed to do? And the reality is that parents are a gigantic consumer population. And I think that one of the things that kids have over parents is a social network before the internet. Their social network on the playground and in school, that's what's driving the social networking online. Parents need to develop that network. If you see Nickelodeon, and this is inappropriate and you don't like it, you need to spread the word. You need to. Parents can develop, because believe me, Nickelodeon wants your kids to go to their site. And if it's because there's that Degrassi High on there, they'll boot it, because they don't want their other advertisers to pull the plug. So the idea is that parents can really be empowered to make change for the better of the whole internet community if they take on that responsibility and just start making those choices and spreading the word about it. And I think that can really empower parents. And you're setting a great example for your kids, too, as far as, taking control and making good choices and literate choices on the internet.
Good. One or two more questions, Braden?
Yeah, I'm Braden Cox. I'm with the NetChoice Coalition, which is a coalition of e-commerce companies like AOL, eBay, Yahoo, and MySpace. Sharon, you mentioned that this doesn't make the 5 o'clock news to say social networking is safe. There's a lot of good things, most of the time, and all the times you hear about the bad things. And, well, it's not headline news either for state AGs to talk about, well, education is important and look at all the benefits of social networking and other types of online activities. Instead, it seems like they're kind of taking advantage of a lot of the fear that both you, Sharon, and Nancy, you mentioned for opportunistic purposes. And quite frankly, it's difficult to try to get anything edgewise into as any kind of education and talking about what really can happen here. We've talked a lot about parents and what we can do to educate them and what's important. What's important for policymakers? What are the three things that you could tell policymakers to focus on here to really keep them, on the right track so we can really make a difference here and keep our kids safe?
I couldn't agree more about the AGs. I mean, some of this ridiculous paranoia. I'm not terribly upset with what the New York Attorney General is doing on Facebook, because maybe there's some merit to that, but some of the stuff that they've been saying about age verification, which simply doesn't work. I would say do your homework, talk to the experts, and realize that, yes, we understand you're elected officials and you need to make political hay, but don't do it at the expense of children, in the name of children, that you need to actually do some research. There are plenty of experts, not just on this panel, and almost everyone you talk to, regardless of their political persuasion, from people who are very, very, very conservative Republicans to people who are very liberal Democrats and on all sides, almost all of them will agree that education is key, that the danger has been way over-exaggerated, and people are focusing on different areas, but almost everyone would agree that many of the things that the AGs are saying make absolutely no sense in reality.
Yeah, and I think you've raised a really important point, and somehow we collectively, because a lot of folks in here are advocacy groups, we've got to get to the National AGs Association. When the Attorney General from Virginia was quoted in NPR saying predators are tracking down personal information and abducting and raping children, I wrote three times to that AG and I said, I want to see the data, because I don't want to misspeak, because I don't think that's what's happening. And so far I have not had a response. But we have especially a couple of AGs who are constantly bad-mouthing this technology, and it is damaging. What it's doing is it is raising the fear of parents, and young people know that their parents are primed to overreact, and so they are not talking to their parents about the risky situations that they're getting into online because of the fear-mongering of the attorneys general.
And we have got to figure out how to get to them and educate them that, guess what, age verification technologies are not going to work because we do not have a national identification system for young people, and we don't want one because it's going to lead to identity theft. We've got to get to them. We absolutely do.
You know, I want to conclude with one last comment slash question for our panel, which is that one thing I've noticed is that there seems to be very much a generational gap problem for both parents and policymakers on this issue. And one of the things I've noticed, the more parents I talk to that are about my age, around 40 and younger, starting to raise kids, and a lot of policymakers, sort of 45 and younger, I hate to make a generalization that's going to get me in trouble, but it's sort of like they get it. And they've been raised in that world. They understand it. Congresswoman Bean's a good example. I mean, she gets this stuff. And yet I'll talk to some, again, I hate to generalize, but older members of Congress, you know, the most interactive media technology in their homes growing up was a black and white television. You know, different world. And how much of this problem maybe goes away, but we're living in this difficult transition period until it does, when today's digital generation grows up.
I think that's an excellent thing to raise, and I think we are kind of a segue generation of parents, and this is all new. It's new to whether you're a parent or not. How it's affecting our society is new, and the impact it's having on every aspect of our society is all new. What I do think is it will continue to get better, and I think that's the great news. But in the meantime, we are still going to be raising the kids that are going to drive the web and drive the internet community. And while we don't necessarily have an experience to draw on from our own childhood, we can apply our basic common sense, the things we know, and our life experience to the things that are happening on the internet. In the same token, we're also raising the next generation of parents who are going to be changing and teaching these skills. So we've got to come up with those strategies, implement them, and then, I think that it's going to continue to get better.
Well, Nancy, one last comment?
Yeah. Both Larry and I are over here kind of chuckling. I'm 55 and he's 60.
Oh, you had to out me, huh?
Yeah. and I'm also a parent of children Sharon's age, and I got news for you. By the time you get to our age, you're going to look back and you're going to be even more freaked out because we digital immigrants are always, no matter what you think you understand now, by the time you're 55, it's going to all change.
There'll be virtual reality in the living room, and my kids will be battling Johnny Depp on the bat in the swashbuckling. Well, hey, folks, we're running out of time, but thank you all for coming. Please join me in thanking our panelists, and buy these books, good books.